Good evening. Wow, it's hot up here. So, welcome, one and all. Is there anybody here for the first time? I think everyone looks familiar. Great. And Edie, if you could let me know when it's about 10 after, just signal. Thank you. Oh, thank you so much, Johnny. So, a Zen student asked a question. And this Zen student said that she was in this time in her life when she was incredibly busy. And she had kind of brought it on herself, it sounded like, but if the way she described it, it sounded like it was just one of those times where, you know, deadlines and crazy and, you know, running around and just feeling really scattered and looking forward to when it was going to be over, which would, I guess, be at the end of this month. Oh, good. I can start living my real life at the end of July. Because this, of course, isn't my real life. This is this busy, crazy time that I'm in that I hate and I wish I wasn't here. And So that's when I'll get to live my real life. Well, she brought this question to her group of Dharma companions, and she was wondering about it. She said, "You know, I realize that I'm having these thoughts, and I'm wondering if am I giving away my life by thinking this way? Because this is where I am. It's not the end of July yet." This is where I am, but I'm not letting myself be here. So what about that? And she brought that question, and I thought, you know, that's the question. That's my question. That's the question I have all the time. And it's a question that shows up in a lot of different variations, so I thought it would be a good question for us to take a look at tonight, because It's this, we have this practice. It's the form and emptiness. It's the absolute and the relative. You know, on the one hand, we have these teachings that, there is no other life. There is no other time. You know, in a way, she was right to be suspicious about her mind imagining that there was this other time, which would be her real life, because this is all we have. You know, no matter what is going on, no matter how much you don't like what's going on, this is it. This is all we have. Just this moment. And that's what we mean by the absolute truth. But on the other hand, we live in the relative world. We live in the world of form. We live in the world where we make choices and we make decisions and we overcommit and we have deadlines and we push up against them and we struggle with them. And that's also our life. That's our life too. So these are the two sides of our lives. And we think that they happen separately, but they actually happen at the same time. And that's the koan, that's the mystery of our Zen practice, is how can that be true? How can two things simultaneously be true? Hi. Welcome. That's why they're known as the two truths, the absolute truth and the relative truth. We don't say there's only one truth. We say there's two. There's probably more, but that's enough for pondering tonight. So, again, on the one hand, there is no other life. There is no other time. But on the other hand, we can make choices in the relative domain as well. So sometimes when we hear about these two truths and the fact of the absolute, it sounds like, well, are we being asked to be passive about the relative truth? Are we being asked to just accept whatever happens and just go with the flow? And well, in a way, yeah, we are. But in the relative world, of course we make choices. So this student even though in the moment she has no other life, she might use that as a learning opportunity. And she might take a look next time she sets up her calendar. I'm talking about myself now, as much as this my Dharma sister. She might use it as an opportunity to look at her calendar and make different choices. Or as somebody else in the group suggested, she might take a look at her time management. You know, it's not that Zen people don't have calendars and have to look at time management and consider the kinds of commitments we make and why do we overcommit ourselves. Those are really important and good questions. But in that moment, in the moment of her busyness, there is no other moment. And to the extent that any of us spend our time longing for the end of July, that's suffering. Because it can't be the end of July. It's July 20. So no matter how much I wish it was the end of July, it's not going to be the end of July until it's the end of July. And as much time as I want to invest in struggling with that fact, that's what we call suffering. Or that's one of the things we call suffering. Wishing that things were different. But this is really hard to do. I mean, it's one thing to hear about this teaching, but it's another thing to actually think of how we practice this in our real lives and with the real challenges that we have and the things that life throws at us that are really hard to be with, that we don't want to be with, and that we want to change. So I wanted to offer a couple of different approaches of ways that maybe we could think about working with this, these two truths, and the ways that they challenge us in our daily life. And I'd like to say a few things and then also find out what you think. So one way to practice with this is to practice with having patience and what is called forbearance, acceptance of what is. It's one of the paramitas, shanti paramita. The paramitas are helpful tools and vehicles that we can practice to help us in our practice for working for the liberation of ourselves and all beings. So shanti paramita, patience, forbearance, acceptance of what is. And I want to give you some teachings about shanti that I have found to be helpful. And none of these teachings are anything that are going to solve the problem. It's not solved by words. It's not solved in the intellectual realm. It's solved only in the experiential realm. So again, we have this dilemma, which we always end up in with Zen, where I'm using words, we use words, the form side, to try to talk about something that cannot be talked about. But that doesn't stop us from doing it, so I'll just continue along. So this is a rating warning. Now, this is going to be a PG-13 lecture, okay? I'm going to use some uncouth language. But they're not my words. They're the words of Basho, a great haiku poet. I don't remember when he lived. Does anybody here? We have many poets in our midst. When was Basho writing? 1300. Okay, so in a way, he was kind of around sort of in Dogen time, I guess, a little bit after, 100 years or so after. So this is a haiku that Basho wrote when he was on pilgrimage, and it was a storm, and he took refuge in a stable. And he wrote this haiku, which is included in a teaching about shanti paramita, this paramita of patience and forbearance and acceptance. It was included by Eitken Roshi, who's one of our great recently died contemporary Zen teachers. So as an expression, actually in what he calls as an expression of the fulfillment of shanti, he offers Basho's haiku. And this is it. Fleas, lice, the horse pissing near my pillow. That's what we call a great Zen poem. Fleas, lice, the horse pissing near my pillow. And Blythe, who I guess is commenting on Basho's poem, I guess he's a contemporary poem commenter, says, "This is not an expression of complaint or disgust, though certainly he felt irritation and discomfort. It is not an expression of philosophical indifference, nor an impossible love of lice and dirt and sleeplessness. It is the feeling these things too." These things too. This busy schedule, this delayed plane, this traffic jam, this cranky client, this aching leg. A monk asked Xiang Lin, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West?" That's a classic question that Zen people ask, that basically means, what's the meaning of Zen? Because Bodhidharma was the founder of Zen. In fact, I think that's him on the altar. He came over from China. I mean, he went from India to China and brought our teaching. So when people say, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? They mean, what is Zen? So a monk asked Xiang Lin, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West?" And he said, "I'm stiff from sitting so long." That's Shanti Paramita, the complete acceptance of things as they are. And yet, I think it's really helpful, Blythe's comment. That doesn't mean that Basho was lying there going, "Oh, I love these fleas and this lice and this." You know, I mean, a horse. I love that image because, you know, horses are big. And I mean, imagine on a rainy, flea-bitten, cold night, and there's this big horse, you know, right next to you, and he writes a poem that endures through the centuries for us to be able to contemplate our own fleas and lice and horse piss and stiffness from sitting so long. Aitken says, "This is the fulfillment of Shanti." And he talks about, and this is kind of interesting, I'd never thought of it this way. You know, we use the word suffering a lot in Buddhism, and Aitken points out that we tend to think of suffering meaning, you know, enduring pain or something, but it's also possible to translate suffer as permission. Suffer that this may happen, or I don't know exactly how it would be used, but it's permission, letting things happen. And so he also offers a quote from Isan Dorsey, who was another one of our relatively recently departed contemporary teachers, a priest, a man in who had AIDS and died of AIDS. And he was a great Zen teacher. And he said, "To have AIDS is to be alive." So this is all Shanti Paramita. This is one way that I thought to bring forward, and we can talk about this in a bit, to practice with this the relative domain of our existence. These things too. This is practice. This very occurrence is practice. There's nothing else. Here's another one. I find this to be one of the best Zen teachings of all time. So I'm really happy that this Dharma sister asked this question, because it allowed for a beautiful little unfolding of finding this quote from Katagiri Roshi, who talked about you know, this whole thing about time. I don't have enough time. You know, what does that mean? I'm busy. This is a busy time. Oh, end of July, that'll be a good time because I won't be so busy. what is this time? What do we mean when we say we don't have time, or we're out of time, or there's not enough time? This is one of our real things we suffer with in our culture. And Dogen, our founder of the way that we practice Zen, who was living just a little bit before Basho, the poet, he talked about it this way, time. He says, we swim on the surface and we walk on the bottom of the ocean. This is the absolute and the relative. We swim on the surface. This is where we live. We live on the surface. We swim where the waves come and we have to adjust to them. And we bob up and we bob down and maybe we get a little bit nauseous as that's happening. Or maybe we ride the wave and we're excited sometimes, the joy of riding the wave. But we also, at the very same time, we walk on the bottom of the ocean. A person who was very dear to me at one point was going through a really, really, really hard time. A lot of challenges, a lot of waves were hitting him, one after the other, pretty relentless. And he sought counsel from a Dharma elder, and she said this, and it was so comforting. She said, just walk on the bottom of the ocean in the middle of this time. Can you feel your feet on the bottom of the ocean, the source place, the silence that is existing at the same time as the busyness? Even in the midst of this difficult time, can you feel your feet on the bottom of the ocean and imagine just the stillness down there, the depth, you know, the lack of waves, the quietness. So in this lovely book that Sally has been recommending to me for a long time, and I finally asked her if I could borrow it, and I started reading it. What's it called again? Every Moment is the Universe? Each Moment is the Universe? It's Katagiri Roshi commenting on Dogen's Being Time. And he writing about this teaching of swimming on the surface and walking on the bottom, and about directly speaking, I think, to the question about, you know, how to think about this busy time in my life when it feels like I'm not living my real life. How to practice with that. Here's some words from Katagiri. And before I say them, I just want to say again, you know, it's so important. I think sometimes we think, oh, you know, if we were perfect Zen students, we wouldn't be busy or we wouldn't overcommit, or, you know, we're hard on ourselves. Maybe you're not, but I am. I'm always hard on myself, and other people tell me that they are hard on themselves, that somehow they're not perfect and calm. And it's not. But that's not the point. That's a misconception. I mean, it's true that we experience profound, you know, we experience the bottom of the ocean. The chant that you all, that we all did together to open up this talk was stunningly beautiful. I just was sitting here just feeling this ocean of sound and humanity, and it was so beautiful, you know. Felt kind of like maybe the quietness. But at the same time, you know, we've all got going on concurrently right now in our heads. You know, it'd be interesting if we turned up the volume on what everybody's thinking during this quiet practice that we do. So here's, again, I find these, I'm just trying to offer a lot of different encouraging words and then open up and ask you how you practice with these dilemmas. He says, how can you take care of time before you go crazy? Try to realize that real time is nothing but dynamic function. So time itself possesses the great power to emancipate you from the limitations of your idea of time. I'm going to read that again. Time, real time, is nothing but dynamic function. It's just the movement of time and space. and it possesses the great power to emancipate us from the limitations of our idea of time. What are the limitations of our idea of time? Well, I think this idea of not enough, too much, or even just the limitations of the hour, the minute, the year, the month, the ways that we chop it up and talk about it as if that was something real, rather than just this construct that can be useful in the form side. Of course, we all appreciate having clocks and, you know, showing up on time and things like that. But essentially, it's just the dynamic function of the universe. Our modern daily life is pretty busy. But can we always be busy? No. You cannot stay with 12 hours or you would go crazy. So busyness has the great power to emancipate itself. That's why you want to find a way to be free from busyness and just be present quietly. Can you stay with quietness? No. Quietness has the great power to act. You cannot stay with timelessness or you would die. So timelessness must become 12 hours again. Timelessness manifests as your daily life. So it's this dynamic interaction, busy, quiet, busy, quiet, busy, quiet. This is how we live. You know, when you're completely quiet, you're dead. Or at least I think that's what it's like. Maybe it wouldn't that be a drag if we, when you get there, it's like busy? Oh my God, I can't even imagine that thought. But I imagine that it's quiet. And then there's our life, which is busy. Busy, quiet, busy, quiet. Swimming on the surface and walking on the bottom of the ocean. It's impossible to understand this intellectually, but you can really do it. Actually, you always do it. It's just that you don't realize it. This is always happening. We're always in this flux. We're always swimming on the surface and we're always walking on the bottom, but somehow we don't realize that. When you understand this, you can use 12 hours instead of being used by them. Right in the middle of the busyness of daily life, you can find tranquility because you know that your life is based on the quietness of timelessness. You need enough calmness or tranquility to see the overall picture of our life. Then you can deal with daily life with a calm mind. But we have limitations. So sometimes you want to be in the wilderness where you can come back to timelessness exactly, and then you can return to work again. I relate to those two, work and the wilderness. So I'm just wondering, before I say any more about my thoughts or about some of the thoughts of some of these others that I've brought, what your thoughts are about what I'm saying, but also what your questions, and also if you find yourself working with this dilemma yourself, what you practice with and how you practice with this. It'd be great to hear a little of that before talking more.
But really, I think what he's saying is that your feet are already there. You just have to look down. You just have to open your eyes to it. So to relate it to Zazen, it's like, you know, you don't sit because you want to reach the bottom. You sit because you just want to be able to look down and see that they're already there. So that's just what came up for me.
What in your life feels like walking on the bottom?
I think it's what I've been working with lately, which is accepting this moment right now. Yeah. It feels very whole.
How can we do that? I struggle so much with that. So many times I don't want to accept what is. Yeah.
I have a question about about Kashanti, which you talk about, and forbearance. And I wonder if you can speak to the relationship between patience and forbearance as it's described in the literature, and creativity.
Creativity. Can you say a little more?
Well, I just think that it's like with pain. You know, it's not a passive acceptance acceptance isn't passive, I don't think. I actually think it's very creative. And so Kashanti Paramita in particular strikes me as really pulling on creativity to problem solve, to work with oneself, one's own impulses. Mm-hmm. You know, irritation, you know, these impulses that we're talking about with patience are mostly sort of things we don't want to be in public. They're not our upsides. When we're talking about patience or other people's upsides, we're talking about, you know, painful areas potentially. Mm-hmm. So, or unskillful areas. Mm-hmm. So I wonder about that in relationship to creativity. And I know you're an artist, and I know also that I know how you work with things and how you go into the wilderness and interact with things, and it's not passive at all.
Yeah.
And nor is your acceptance passive at all. I've never seen you passive in terms of your... So how do you see yourself, I guess, with forbearance in these terms when you're not passive at all? Mm-hmm. And yet you have accepted tremendous...
Yeah.
Challenging things.
Yeah, well...
So I think you already have it.
Well, I'm thinking, as you're talking, of one of my own kind of breakthrough insights that I had that I know I've shared with you visually, and let me see if I can do this. So for a long time, I had this... I always think I'm supposed to be... calmer and more clear-minded than I experience that I am. And so for a long time, I've had this sort of mystical place in my psyche that I call the pool of clarity. And I even imagine that it looks like the pool at Tassajara, the warm pool outside that it's surrounded by stones, and it's this pool of clear mind, peaceful abiding. And I think, well, I'm supposed to be there. And so I get happy when I feel like I'm there, and irritated and impatient when I feel like I'm not there. And so, you know, if you read my journals, you could read this back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So one time I was, the art side. So it's an irritation. I don't like it. I feel like it should be different. And what I did was, and it was just an, I don't know where it came from, whether it was, you know, I don't know what creativity is. It's some kind of urge to do something with your life, with your feelings, with your thoughts. So I did this picture, and if you can picture this, here's this picture of the pool of clarity, and I drew me. And what it looked like was, here I'm at the pool of clarity, and then there was this line that went, wow, and then, you know, not at the pool of clarity, going somewhere else, and then I would return. And then I would go off on another foray, and then I would return. And then I would go off on another foray, and I would return, because I always return. This is the both sides. This is the busy, quiet, you know. I mean, for as much as I like to talk about feeling like it's all busy and I'm not there, there's a lot of time when it's quiet and peaceful, and I feel like, well, I am at the pool of clarity. But what I realized was, when I saw this picture of this place and this journey, I realized, who's to say that that itself isn't my perfect map of my territory? So it's like if you colored in, can you kind of picture that? Colored in what I thought was erraticism and being off the path. If I color it in, it's a perfect something. It's the perfect picture of the truth of this one. The truth of this one. And so the acceptance in that case for me is, I may always be a person who feels like she's only half the time at the pool of clarity. Can I accept that? Can I accept that one? You know? And so the creativity, the role of creativity for me was in somehow breaking that feeling of the dualistic way that I had constructed the story and the acceptance of the truth of this circumstance, which is that there it is, you know? That's me. That's my path. That's, you know what I mean?
So once you see that, then do you think Ashanti just opens to you? It's not like you're making this great effort to be patient and exercise forbearance, but in fact, you're exercising creativity, you're studying yourself, you're mm-hmm. looking at the mm-hmm. question, mm-hmm. and from mm-hmm. that exploration, mm-hmm. that really energetic mind mm-hmm. comes, mm-hmm. oh, mm-hmm. okay.
And as you recall, you know, that image, I mean, you taught me about the soul collage process, and which is just real briefly, you make cards for the different aspects of your psyche, and then you read them, so it's like a tarot, but it's your own imagery and archetypes. And so that picture of this path and noticing that that's what it is, I call that card total self-acceptance. That's the name of that card, total self-acceptance. And I really appreciate you bringing the piece about that I don't experience it as passive. It's like Zazen, you know, when people say, oh, it must be so relaxing. You go and you, like, oh, you're going to go to a retreat, you know, and everybody's laughing, right? Some of the time, of course it is. Of course, sometimes it's very, very peaceful. But a lot of the time, you know, it's hard work. It's really hard work. Edie, what time is it?
7:12.
Oh, okay, good. So, actually, there's lots of time. Yes.
So, what struck me as you were discussing this issue of time and being with it earlier on was that the best for me is when I lose my sense of self. And it's not like that time disappears on the road. Even if it's within my constraints of 2 hours, where I actually forget about myself. Mm.
Well, what are some of the kinds of activities that in which you experience that you lose your attachment to the particularities of self?
Well, it's always some kind of creative process, right? Writing or even reading, you know, learning new things that can apply to my creative process. Mm-hmm. My judgment out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to just take care of this time issue. But momentarily, I just don't think about it. And it's there and it's okay. But
I just don't think about it. And then I'm free. Katagiri also uses the example of athletes and the experience that we have when we're watching athletes who are, you know, when it's happening so fast and they're so in the game or in the sport, you can't think about what's going on. I mean, that is part, or you know, dance, or I mean, in any variety of physical activities that we can do. In fact, he has a quote that I thought was really beautifully said. He says, "They manifest their hope in the moment. The frame of their skandhas and senses disappear within the total manifestation of activity. When only action is there, something happens. By their full devotion to athletic performance," and you could substitute there any activity that you put your full attention into, "they change the structure of time and space." I think this is exactly what you just said. And this is, he says, "That's why if you watch the performance of athletes, you feel beautiful." Or I think live theater, maybe. Or, I mean, there's any number of different times when we have that experience. Or ceremony, maybe even, you know, in the Zendo, ceremony together, or meetings sometimes when I'm doing my work and I'm facilitating a meeting, and you know, there's no separation. Music, the musical concert, these things that we seek out, these activities of complete absorption that can be encouraging.
I'm intrigued by the surface and bottoming thing. Surface, many times for me, is the conventional definition of words, and bottom, walking at the bottom, is what I render as my, if you will, spiritual definition of words. So, two words that were mentioned were patience and acceptance. And the surface effect of patience for me is it has this idea of waiting for, you know, this idea of forbearance. But the deep practice of patience for me is the cultivation of being fully present.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm fully present, I'm not waiting for anything. So there's that bit part. Acceptance has this, in the conventional sense, in the surface effects, has this often has this characteristic of being something icky that I have to tolerate,
mm-hmm.
endure.
The fleas and the lice.
Fleas and the lice, like, oh, God, you know, the horse. I had horses, I know this. I had horses, I know all these things. I had to throw out of the house, and I've been there, so I know this. But so there's that part of it, but the practice of acceptance for me is stating with accuracy what is obvious, nothing more or less, which means identifying the narrative and saying, oh, that's narrative, but what is the fact? Is the lice, is the flea, is the horse piss, is my pillow? That's the fact. So the deep part of that. There's another one too, and you mentioned the athletes, and that has to do with concentration, which is part of many meditation practices. And the surface effect of concentration is to stare at something, to the exclusion of everything else, I suppose. But the deep effect of that, the deep practice of concentration, is actually putting everything, seeing everything, taking everything in the manner that has a common center.
Mm-hmm.
And you see athletes do this who are getting ready to do long jumps. You can see them just go, boom, 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 boom. They take in the whole stadium, everything's going there. When they got everything in the same center, then they move.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they stay. So this idea of concentration happens. So when I am bothered by something in the future and I have some fear, or I'm bothered by something in the past and I have some resentment, or I have some kind of envy or shame about things not being the way I like them, this practice of just stating exactly what they are, the practice of being fully present to them, and the practice of broadening to embrace simultaneously the past, the future, and the other nows, it could be, for a common center,
mm-hmm.
never leaves the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow in that place, I can do the simple thing right here that is the appropriate alignment for all of those things on the full horizon.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where Zazen sitting come in for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'll often come in with centers all over the place, and if I can just do that for a little bit, then the noise suddenly becomes orchestrated. The noise suddenly becomes humble.
Yeah, I think that there's all these different ways that we find to, you know, study ourselves and understand, like you're describing, you've really paid attention to the different ways that your mind functions, and so, you know, you find that way to come to center. And you describe for you the way that you're finding to come to center. So, I mean, so much of this is finding our own way with this seeming duality. And finding our way to be with it. Yeah. Yeah.
Thinking about the ocean metaphor.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that actually the floor of the ocean is not flat. And it has shape, and it has ups and downs, and it has deep canyons. And to the extent that we're walking on that surface, we're not walking on the floor of the ocean, we're not walking on a flat surface.
and the shape of the bottom influences what's on the top.
Mm-hmm.
Waves breaking, sandbar, and whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in some way, I'm thinking we're the connection
mm-hmm.
between
mm-hmm.
what's on the bottom
mm-hmm.
and the manifestation mm-hmm. of what's on the bottom that appears as the waves. So we're the connection.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Our own deep structure.
It's, yeah.
Our own deep structure is in intimate relationship
yeah.
with the way that the surface is playing because they're the same thing.
They're manifested.
Yeah.
But we are. Yeah.
We're different. They're different aspects of the same being.
But, and they're connected to us.
Mm-hmm. I had these kind of wild notes for this talk because I wasn't exactly sure where I wanted to go with it. Something about this, you know, the self-acceptance piece. What is, I mean, ultimately that's our refuge, is to be the one that we are. And to realize that we don't have to torture ourselves, that we're not the one that we're not. And I don't know why that's so hard. Maybe for some it isn't. But I know for me it is. And for a lot of the people I know it is. I think that patience is a real gift that we can give to one another. The patience to allow each other to be the way we are and to make space for each other as we are. You know, we talked a little bit about this in group the other night. What it feels like to be given the gift of somebody else's patience with your own maybe less than perfect ways. Is there anything else? Thank you all for. Oh, you're just. That's your response. Okay. I think, okay, no, we're done. Write our own haiku for the particular circumstances of our lives. I guess that, you know, this style of lecture, I offer these different, they're like friends to me, you know, they're like friends. And that's what encourages my practice, is my friends. You know, all of you, and, you know, some in particular and others maybe in the future. That's what supports me to be willing to keep on and keep coming forth. So these folks, you know, be they contemporary or alive or dead, or be they old from, you know, 1200 or 1300, they all feel like friends. And I feel like there's so many encouraging words that people have offered to us over the years that I just really encourage everybody to find friends, Zen friends, be they physical friends or be they book friends. There's so much support out there for this strange and wonderful practice that we do. So, in celebration of friends and encouragement of the way, beings are numberless. I found would save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.